You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a group in the Kaukauna area is trying to track farm runoff heading into the Fox River. We'll find out what the researchers are hoping to learn and how it could affect water protection. First, the race for a spot on Wisconsin's Supreme Court is underway. Three candidates will be on the primary election ballot on February 20th. The candidates are Madison attorney Tim Burns, Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge Rebecca Dallett, and Sauk County Circuit Court Judge Michael Skrenek. They are running for a 10-year seat on the court. We'll be interviewing the candidates this week on Central Time. That starts tomorrow at 4. Jolly Emery joins us now. She's a political scientist at UW-Whitewater. Jolly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, this is a nonpartisan election, officially meaning that the candidates don't register as Republicans or Democrats. That said, partisan leanings always seem to be a big part of the story. Is that happening this time around?
Oh, yeah, and perhaps more openly than it has in some of the primaries. For example, Tim Burns is very open about his positions, and he calls himself a progressive, says he's very liberal, and that he wants to bring his preferences to the court. He thinks it's important that the court change in terms of its more conservative ideology. So a lot of openness here on his part. The other two candidates aren't quite as open as he is, but it's still not hard to see where they lean ideologically.
Yeah, can you talk about the leanings? Let's start with Rebecca Dallett.
So Rebecca Dallett, she comes across somewhat as a moderate, but probably a little bit left-leaning moderate. She is being fairly strategic in terms of how she's running her candidacy for the court. She wants to make sure that she not only captures Democrats who are not going to vote for Skrenek, but that she captures the moderates as well, which will make up more of the voters than would just capturing the liberals, which Tim Burns is trying to do.
And then where is Michael Skrenek falling in this race?
Well, Skrenek is conservative, and he doesn't necessarily refer to himself in political terms. In fact, he prefers to talk about how, as a justice on the court or as a judge, you should be apolitical. You kind of put the robe on and you put all of your preferences aside, and then you just look at the law and you determine those cases according to the law. And he talks a lot about the rule of law. But at the same time, given some of his activities as an attorney, it's clear that he has some conservative leanings. And that's kind of what we would call restraintist attitude about deferring to legislative bodies and just interpreting the law is considered to be a fairly conservative viewpoint for a justice.
And we see, if you look at endorsements for candidates, some will have all Democrats, some will have all Republicans.
Yeah.
And frequently we get press releases from a partisan group or the party or whatever praising the one candidate for their independence and their, unwillingness to go under an ideological label. But only one side is praising that candidate for it. Has it always been this way?
Well, that's a really good question. So to some degree, it's always been this way. But I think that in terms of judicial elections, they've become more salient to outside interest groups and other parties, not so much to the voters. The voters still, turn out in fairly low numbers because in Wisconsin in particular, these elections happen at in the spring as opposed to the general election in November. And they're just, don't really appeal too much to the voters. But at the same time, they appeal to a lot of other groups that are interested in what kind of outcomes the Supreme Court might make, what kind of decisions they might make. And conservative groups are going to want to make sure that you keep a conservative majority on the court. Now, you will keep one, regardless of what happens, because it's just one justice. In fact, that's how Wisconsin works. Only one justice runs, or one seat is one justice's seat is up for election in any given year. And so Gableman, who decided after a term that he no longer wants to serve on the court and he's not running for re-election, his seat is an open seat. And if a conservative gets elected to it, the court's ideological composition remains the same. If Burns were elected as the most liberal yeah, he'd be another liberal, but there'd still just be three liberals on the court and four conservatives. So it's important, I think, for certain groups to try to maintain that conservative majority on the court. And at the same time, you know, liberal groups will want to see to at least try and get more of a liberal voice on the court.
Talking to Jolly Emery from UW-Whitewater about the Supreme Court election here in Wisconsin. We'll meet the candidates through the course of the week starting tomorrow at 4. Jolly, let's talk about that voter now. In theory, if you're voting in this election, you might think, okay, I want to elect a good judge, but I'm not sure how I would measure that. So is ideological leaning a useful proxy for people, at least one way to help make a decision?
Yeah, I think so to some degree, if they know. Okay, so depending upon how much research they are willing to put into finding out about the candidates, and there are certainly the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel does a really good job in reporting on these candidates. You do a great job reporting on those candidates, but you know, you have to be willing to research and look at you know, what they say about themselves. So Burns obviously is unabashed in how he talks about himself as a progressive, so it's pretty easy to know who he is. I think the other two are a little bit more reserved in how they describe themselves politically and with regard to politics and judicial decision making. But at the same time, I think that they have a benefit over Burns in that they're both judges. So they can both speak to that judicial experience. And I think when people are looking at the positions that the candidates have held, they're going to want to select a judge over someone who hasn't been a judge in many instances.
A lot of times in these races, we see campaign ads, often from outside groups, relying on past rulings of a judge who was serving in a lower court, often on criminal cases, you know, saying they weren't tough enough on a criminal suspect, something like that. How important is that kind of background in terms of what a Supreme Court justice is actually doing?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know, you know, overall, looking at all races across the different states who elect their Supreme Court justice, how important that is, but for the most part, I think I could say that most people prefer a judge to appear to be law and order. There have been instances where judges have not gotten reelected because they've appeared to be soft on crime when there have been ads, campaign ads, reporting on their records. So it doesn't look good, I think, for a candidate who's running for the Supreme Court to appear to be soft on crime.
And then can you talk a little bit about what a state Supreme Court, or at least Wisconsin Supreme Court, is responsible for? What, when we go and vote for somebody, what are we setting them up for here?
Okay, so when you're voting for them, the Wisconsin State Supreme Court has both original jurisdiction. In some instances, original jurisdiction means that they hear cases for the first time, but that's pretty limited in scope. Most of their work is appellate, and appellate cases are cases that have been heard at lower courts. So what the Wisconsin Supreme Court does is look to see if lower courts have made some error with respect to rulings. And then the court will determine that. They'll vote, and they'll determine whether or not the error has happened. And if it's occurred and there is error, then they reverse the lower court, or if there's no error, they uphold it. Where it becomes really important for us as citizens of the state, our residents of the state, is with respect to those more political types of cases that come before the court. And we've seen a lot of those, you know, Act 10 probably being one of the most famous, the John Doe investigations, plural, I should say. When those things come to the court and those decisions are made, they can have a pretty big impact on people who live within the state.
And Jolly, before I let you go, I mean, we talked to you years ago after accusations of violence among state Supreme Court members at other state Supreme Court members. Do we have any sense that it's a little more civil these days?
It does seem to be, well, we don't hear about that anymore, right? And one of the justices who was at the center of that is no longer on the court. So it seems to be more civil these days. You know, and we're not dealing with the same, Act 10 was such a huge issue, and we're not dealing with that right now. Certainly there are other important cases that the court has dealt with since then and will continue to deal with in the future, but people seem to be getting along a bit better, yes.
We'll leave it there for now. Jolly, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jolly Emery, political scientist at UW-Whitewater. She joined us for a look at the upcoming Wisconsin Supreme Court race. We'll meet the candidates, all three of them, starting tomorrow at 4 on Central Time. First, there's an ongoing effort to prevent chemicals, soil, and manure draining off of farm fields and into Wisconsin's waterways. There's a variety of methods in use, but which ones are the most effective? The Fox Wolf Watershed Alliance is looking to answer that question with the help of a new grant. They're developing a database to track different runoff protections being used near two creeks in the Kaukauna area that are connected to the Fox River. Jessica Schultz is the executive director of the Fox Wolf Watershed Alliance. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, before we get into this new project, let's talk about what's at stake. What are we concerned about if we have soil and other pollutants running off into waterways?
Right now, our lower Fox River and the Bay of Green Bay is impaired by sediment and nutrients like phosphorus that's causing dead zones in the Bay of Green Bay and increased algal blooms, including those blue-green algae blooms that we're seeing that are very harmful to human health.
And what are some of the methods that people are using right now to try to keep all that stuff from getting into streams, rivers, and then the Great Lakes?
I think it's really important to note that runoff, polluted runoff from our landscape, not just agricultural runoff, but also urban runoff, is contributing to those problems that we're seeing in the waters. So our urban communities, we're seeing an increase of like stormwater detention basins or ponds that we're seeing in our communities. Or green infrastructure projects are happening in the urban sector. And then there's a lot being done in the agricultural world as well, including like cover crops and different tillage practices. We're trying some new technologies like treatment wetlands to deal with agricultural runoff. There's so much happening right now in water quality initiatives. And so we are trying to see what is really working, what is protecting our waters.
And that takes us to this new database you've developed. What exactly are you tracking? What are you doing?
So the database that we're working on developing in conjunction with Outagamie County, Brown County, Calumet County, and Winnebago County is to track land conservation practices, mostly in the agricultural world, that are being installed on the landscape. What's going to go into this database is all the practices that are being implemented through the county land conservation departments working with the landowners and the producers in the watershed. What we're hoping to see is an impact in the water quality when we really strategically spend our dollars on the landscape.
So how will that play out in practice? What are you actually going to do to try to track that?
So in the Pullman-Kankapaa Creek watersheds, the Pullman-Kankapaa Creek watersheds are in the Kaukauna-Wrightstown area. Those watersheds have received some Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding. Just under $5 million is going into best management practices in those watersheds to install things like cover crops, to change agricultural producers' tillage practices, to put in grass waterways and buffer strips, and do some stream bank restoration. So it's going to take a whole host of practices and ultimately like a change in farm management to get to where we need to be to see the water quality improve. But we're hoping with a very strategic plan and heavy implementation focused in those two watersheds that we're going to see that water quality improve and then know the suite of practices that we need to get out on the landscape through the rest of the watershed.
Let's get up close and personal with those two creeks you mentioned, the Plum and the Kankapaa, as you said, by Kaukauna and Wrightstown. Tell us about those creeks.
Those are hardworking. That's a hardworking watershed for agricultural landscape. We chose those two creeks because those are the highest loading phosphorus and sediment to the Fox River. Those are the two highest creeks per agricultural acre. So the DNR completed a large study called a TMDL, a total maximum daily load, was completed in 2015. And that study broke out each kind of sub-watershed in the lower Fox and said, what types of landscapes are contributing to the phosphorus and sediment problem that we're seeing in the Lower Fox. And out of that study, it came that the Plum and the Kinkapot Creek were the highest loading per agricultural acre. There's other watersheds that were higher loading than the Plum and Kinkapot, but had more of an urban component. So because we were developing this tool for agriculture, and because there was Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funding available to do agricultural best management practices, we chose to target that Plum and Kinkapot Creek. And we're glad we did. We have a lot of great partners working in that watershed. The producers that live in that area are very open to trying new conservation practices and really being part of the solution.
We're talking to Jessica Schultz, Executive Director of the Fox Wolf Watershed Alliance, talking about a new effort to promote practices in agriculture and elsewhere, trying to keep sediment and phosphorus out of waterways, and also to measure what seems to work, what gives the most results for dollars spent. And Jessica, what strikes me there about what you're talking about is how interconnected the water systems are. If we want to help the Lower Fox River or the Great Lakes, we really have to look upstream, don't we?
We do. What's really great about when you think about working from a watershed perspective, our watersheds do not form to our municipal boundaries or our county boundaries. We're seeing really great partnerships being developed through all of the county land conservation departments and county governments in general. We are seeing municipalities talk back and forth with each other when it comes to urban stormwater management. It's really a partnership based upon watershed boundaries and not our lines that we've drawn from municipal boundaries.
And Jessica, you mentioned that the producers, the farmers themselves, seem to be pretty enthusiastic about trying new stuff. Talk about what you've heard from some of them.
Yeah, what we're really trying to do is find those win-win solutions. We are looking for, loss of words right now, but we're looking for practices that are beneficial to the farm and beneficial to our waterways. So those practices that improve soil health, like cover crops, improve the soil, ultimately increasing the yields and decreasing the input that farmers need to put in for their management practice or for the management of their farm. So we're looking for practices that are good for the farm and ultimately good for the water quality in the region. And that's where we're seeing people really get on board. It's much easier to deliver to do an ask of a conservation practice if it's not going to be bad for their farm or if it's cost effective for their farm. But it takes a while. We don't see that immediate improvement in soil health. A lot of these practices, it takes 5 to 7 years to see that change and to see it beneficial to their farm. So we need to be here as conservationists helping the producers through that the first few years where they may see a decrease in yield for their crops.
How quickly do these results show up in the water itself?
That's to be determined yet. I wish I had that answer for you. As part of our project, we are doing water quality monitoring through the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay. We're doing monitoring at edge of field for some of the conservation practices, and then we're also doing monitoring in the stream for Plum and Kinkapot Creeks. Like I said, we're doing heavy implementation in those two creeks so we can see how quickly it turns those streams around. And we're just we're about 2.5 years into our project. So we're hoping that we see that turn. I can say that there's a demonstration farm network working in the Lower Fox River through the NRCS and Brown County Land Conservation Department. And they have some pretty great results with their edge of field monitoring for practices. There's a video of conservation practices on one part of the field and not on another part of the field, and you can see the water quality difference leaving the part of the field that has the conservation practices on. So some things we can see immediately, and other things we're going to have patience for and hope to see the benefits in the stream and ultimately in the river and then the Bay of Green Bay.
Are you hoping to take this super up-close look at these two creeks and their watersheds take some lessons from it and be able to apply it elsewhere in the Fox River watershed, or even be able to export these ideas to other people?
That's definitely what we're hoping for. The GIS database tool that has been developed with funds from the Community Foundation of the Fox Valley will also help more immediately. So the conservation tracking tool that has been developed is going to aid in efficiencies of land conservation departments. What we're seeing is an increased amount of workload to our land conservation departments without an increased amount of staff. So we created this tool to help make sure that the funds that are going to land conservation departments to put practices on the ground are tracked, and a tool that will increase the verification, making sure that we're accountable for the dollars that are going out on the landscape. So that's a tool that even if we don't see the water quality response immediately, we're hoping that that tool can go out not just in the lower Fox River, but spread throughout the greater Fox Wolf Basin and ultimately the state to help with increased efficiencies in land conservation departments.
We'll leave it there for now. Jessica, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That's Jessica Schultz, Executive Director of the Fox Wolf Watershed Alliance. With the help of a new grant, the group is developing a database to track which methods of runoff protection, we're talking about things like phosphorus and sediment, are the most effective. Now, when we think of Mexican Americans, there's a good chance that we think about the ongoing debate over immigration, both legal and undocumented. But Mexican American identity goes back way longer than the modern immigration debate, to the mid-1800s, when there was a big jump in the number of Mexican American people living within the borders of the United States. But at that time, the people didn't move, the border did. Our next guest says this was a pivotal moment in the history of Mexican American identity that still echoes in today's headlines. Laura E. Gomez joins us now. She's a professor of law, sociology, and Chicano studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She's the author of Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Rob. Happy to be here.
Let's start, Laura, at that pivotal moment in American history, what we now call the Mexican-American War in the 1840s. The U.S. Effectively conquers a big chunk of territory, keeps it in a post-war treaty. All the people living there are in American territory now. Tell us about the Mexicans who found the border moving out from under them.
What's fascinating is that there were 115,000 Mexican, non-tribal, non-Indian Mexicans living in that vast region, which actually was half of Mexico's territory. So if you just think about the territory, half of it being lopped off and taken by the U.S., it kind of puts the contemporary immigration debate in a little bit of a different light. But at that moment, overnight, those Mexicans became federal citizens. Now, if they lived in California and they lived in Texas, they became fairly quickly state citizens as well. But the book mostly focuses on two-thirds of that group, which I call the original Mexican-Americans or the first Mexican-Americans. And those two-thirds lived in the New Mexico Territory, which at that time included Arizona, Nevada, parts of Utah, parts of Wyoming. And in that big territory, it was under the status federal territorial status like Puerto Rico is today. And New Mexico and Arizona didn't become a state until 1912. So what you had was between 1848 and 1912, Mexican Americans in this kind of political limbo where they didn't have voting representatives in Congress. They didn't have, for example, the laws that they enacted could be overturned by Congress, by the U.S. Congress. And so there were elements that were really very much a second-class citizenship, even though it was citizenship.
And they were in a weird position, the people of Mexican descent now in this territory, as you say. In some ways, legally, they were treated as white citizens. In some ways, socially, they were not. They were in this gray area from their own perspective and from the perspective of the government.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because at that time in the mid-19th century, our immigration laws only allowed white people to become naturalized citizens. So that was the legal fiction under which Mexicans at that time were allowed to become federal citizens. So in a sense, we're saying, okay, wink, wink, they're white. But at the same time, the reality is very clear. If you look at newspapers of the time and you look at incidents of the time, you see that people were not really thinking of Mexicans then as white, even though among Mexicans then and now, there's a lot of racial difference, right? There's people who have more Spanish ancestry. There's people who have African ancestry because Mexico had a huge slave trade in the 17th century. And there's people who have indigenous ancestry, of course, and a combination of all three of those. This notion that Mexican-Americans were helped by being in this ambiguous status. And, for example, Mexican-American men in the federal territory of New Mexico could vote, could run for territorial office, but African-American men couldn't vote. Native American men couldn't vote, and so on. So there was an in-between status.
Talking to Laura E. Gomez about her book, Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. And I want to focus in on the R word there, Laura, race. As you point out in the book, and people have pointed out a lot, there's no biological scientific definition for race. It's what we humans make of it. But that's really powerful. How do you see the idea of a Mexican-American racial category emerging from that starting point in New Mexico?
Well, I like to think of it as something that had actually started historically earlier than the U.S. period, and that was with the Spanish conquest of the what is today the southwestern United States and Mexico and Latin America. And that system of colonialism of the Americas very much had a hierarchy where Indians were inferior to Spaniards. And then you had gradations in between. And then what happens when you see that society mix with the U.S. society in the mid-19th century is you see the Americans, Euro-Americans, trying to make sense and say, well, who are these Mexicans? Are they more like African-Americans? We understand African-Americans because we have slavery. Or are they like Native Americans? Well, they don't seem like Native Americans, although they do in some ways, right? And there was this question and really this kind of back and forth in ways big and small about where Mexican Americans fit during that time period. I think that the moment of contact with the United States made it very clear to Mexican Americans, even those who were relatively elite at the time, who might have had some wealth, say, in ranching or farming, those people very much felt that they were inferior in the American racial system. And so one of the things that happened is they developed a narrative that they were not Mexican, but that they were Spanish. And this is what I call a legal fiction or a kind of a social fiction. But it allowed people to say, for example, well, we have one drop of Spanish blood, therefore we're white, therefore we're European. And I contrast that to the notion of one drop of black blood, which we know after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, starts to become solidified as kind of the racial rule for African Americans in the United States. So all of these ideas, like you said, these are part of the social context that changes over time. But individuals come into that context. They don't just come in on a clean slate and say, "Oh, I want to change my race," you know, like Rachel Dolezal did in Washington State a couple years ago. A lot of people found that really problematic because we actually do have a common understanding of these things, even though it changes over time, as you said.
another group that you compare Mexican Americans to is various immigrants, immigrant groups from Europe, who are white, and so they might, you know, Irish Americans would stand out at least at first, but over the course of 2-3 generations, they fit into the white category, no longer thought of as a separate community, an immigrant community. With Mexican Americans, something different seems to have happened. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and just, you know, it's actually interesting to talk about the contemporary moment. So if you look at the number of the people who are undocumented immigrants in the U.S. right now, you might be surprised to know that a lot of them are actually Irish nationals. And they're undocumented because they came here on tourist visas and they've overstayed their visas. But they sort of live their lives in the U.S. Without being singled out as immigrants, much less as undocumented immigrants. On the other side of things, you've got this kind of continual replenishment, if you will, of Mexican immigrants and Mexican laborers, right? So you have that original population, but then you have recruitment of Mexican laborers. And sometimes you have economic conditions under which Americans don't want Mexican labor, right? And we're kind of in that one of those phases right now where there's certainly a big split about that. But the Irish Americans and the Italian Americans, they over one or two generations became very squarely white, whereas what I would say has happened with Mexican Americans is that we were kind of in this in-between sort of off-white category in the 19th century, and we've become even more clearly non-white today. And that's a bit controversial, so I think you know, it could be that some members of your audience have different views or that you want to hear a little bit more about that, but, you know, given the way that Mexican nationality and Hispanic status generally has been demonized in terms of the presidential campaign in 2016 and in terms of the President Trump's language, even most recently, right? Like thinking about last week at the State of the Union address and so forth, a lot of Latinos are feeling discrimination increasing, not decreasing, and so sort of moving in the other direction toward the non-white side rather than toward the white side like European groups have done.
Laura Gomez is with us now talking about her book Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, thoughts, and experiences. Why do you think Mexican-Americans have been viewed differently than other groups in the United States? If this is you, if you have Mexican-American heritage yourself, going back one generation or seven generations, what do you think of all this? Do you think you are viewed differently, stigmatized, maybe stereotyped in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Sorry, make that the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Laura Gomez is with us, author of Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race. She's talking about Mexican-American identity and how it's been shaped over 150 years of American history and what it all means today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? What questions do you have for our guest? Do you feel like there is a stigma, a growing stigma, maybe directed at Mexican-Americans in American society? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email talk@WPR.org. And Laura, you were talking about the present day since the 2016 election. Talk a little more about what you're seeing, how the category of Mexican-American is being treated, maybe differently, changing as we're watching here.
Well, so I think that there are ways that we can go back to, for example, candidate Trump's first announcement that he was seeking the presidential election. So this was July of 2015, and that's the speech in which he said, "Mexico is sending us its rapists, is sending us its drug dealers," and made that a central part of his campaign, and indeed it's continued to be a central theme in his campaign. But that was a moment in which, you know, we had that wasn't new in American politics, right? We had certainly seen that if you think about Willie Horton in the Dukakis and George W.H. Bush election, the trope of the African-American male criminal. But I think this was a really interesting moment where Trump was willing to say out loud, and the crowds were willing to really embrace this idea of, well, we are threatened by Mexican men. And you can think of many examples during the course of the campaign. Another one was when Trump called the judge who was hearing the case in his lawsuit, the lawsuit against Trump University, and Trump referred to that judge as quote-unquote Mexican, even though that judge was born in Indiana to Mexican parents. And it was an interesting moment in which I think a lot of Mexican Americans that I know felt like, wow, even somebody who's this accomplished, right, an Article III judge, is being dismissed and demonized in this way. Now, one thing that was interesting about that moment is Paul Ryan spoke up right away and said that told Trump that was racist to call it a judge biased simply because of his parents' nationality. I think that Ryan has more recently backed off in some of these debates about what is racist and what is not racist, such as the comment that Trump reportedly made in the Oval Office and those kinds of things. But these are of a piece. These are the times that we're in.
I want to go to a caller now. We've got Jeremiah on the line in La Crosse. Jeremiah, hi.
Hi there. He's going to tear off my speaker phone.
Go for it, Jeremiah.
Hi. So, my name is Jeremiah. So I'm a third-generation Mexican-American. So my grandfather migrated up from Mexico back in the 50s. He worked at Cat for Cat, and he was a legal immigrant at that time, so all the papers and stuff. And it was it's always interesting. So when people, they always ask my last name and my heritage because my last name is Galvan. And when I tell them that, you know, Mexican is kind of part of my heritage, I always get this really surprised look because I look very white. And then what follows is a bunch of questions and then like, oh, really? And I think some of it is interest, but at the same time, you know, I am in a leadership role where I work. And so sometimes I always wonder, because growing up, there was always this almost a struggle of identity to figure out, like, who am I? Because I don't look Mexican, and yet that is a part of who I am, too.
Jeremiah, thanks a lot for the call. Laura, Jeremiah, probably not alone in that story.
That's right. It's a very thank you for sharing those thoughts, Jeremiah. And I think that especially being Mexican-American in the Midwest, right, and there weren't a lot of you, although there have always been, at least since the, you know, late 19th century, there have been Mexican-Americans in the Midwest. I'm thinking back to a community in Kansas, in Topeka, Kansas, that grew up around the railroad, right, where Mexican labor was recruited in. And now those Mexican-Americans who are still there, they're like fourth and fifth generation Mexican-Americans. So I think this notion of who is Mexican and who is not, sometimes in the group itself, we enforce that in ways that aren't very welcoming to others. But at the same time, that reflects some of the racism in the larger community. And one thing that would be interesting if we had more time would be to hear people's stories about how their parents tried to ensure that they experienced less discrimination over time. And sometimes that meant making sure they did not speak Spanish, right, because they didn't want them to get that kind of discrimination. And then that sometimes has the effect of making people feel, people like me who don't speak Spanish well, sometimes feeling like, oh, wow, I'm not, quote-unquote, as Mexican as someone else. So, you know, there are lots of interesting variations on this, but I think Jeremiah is in good company.
And Laura, I wanted to ask about a kind of a persistent concept that's out there, the idea that Mexican-Americans are not assimilable, like the idea that, okay, Croatian and Polish and Irish immigrants all eventually assimilated. It's not going to happen for some reason with Mexican-Americans. Can you talk about that concept?
It's a very persistent idea that Mexican-Americans, and you sometimes also hear this about some Asian-Americans, that they're perpetual foreigners, right? That no matter how long they stay here, they're going to stay in their little enclaves and they're not going to assimilate. But the evidence doesn't show that. The evidence, in fact, shows that within a generation or two, everybody is speaking Spanish. There's
English.
More. Sorry, go ahead.
You're saying everybody's speaking Spanish? Did you mean English?
I'm sorry, I meant English. Okay. I meant English. Everybody is speaking English, and people are marrying, for example, folks like it sounds like in Jeremiah's family outside of their group, and so, you know, there's now at the same time. I guess I want to say here's the caveat. At the same time, you don't quite see the pattern that you see with European immigrants, where really, if we look now at our Italian Americans marrying Italian Americans, there's like almost none who are, right, in the aggregate, looking at the issue sociologically and looking at Irish Americans. So we're not quite at that point, but some scholars say Mexican Americans are a little bit in between. There's not quite as much assimilation as happens. One reason this may be is because we have had constant, continuous immigration from Mexico across time, right? So it wasn't like there was just this big immigration in the, you know, 1910s and 1920s during the Mexican Revolution, and then it stopped. It's been pretty continuous. Today, of the 10 states that have experienced the greatest growth in their Hispanic population under the last census, 9 of those 10 states were in the South. And they were states like Georgia, where the Hispanic population is under 10% of the state population, but it's grown dramatically, or at least I'm talking about 2010 data here. So between 2000 and 2010, it grew dramatically. And I think in those instances, you have a kind of a different phenomenon than what you have, say, in California and Arizona and New Mexico, right, where there has been this long presence of Mexican Americans.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to Laura E. Gomez. Her book is Manifest Destinies: The Making of the Mexican American Race.